The Whitewater Baldy Complex fire currently burning in southwestern New Mexico is the largest wildfire in that state's history. To this point, it has burned more than 241,000 acres. That's about 380 square miles, and it is only about 17% contained. Forestry officials and fire experts say that fires like this are becoming the norm. And some of them have even said that in the future, a combination of fire fuel, a lack of understanding of nature and climate change, will all lead to fires that make this one puny by comparison. In a moment, we'll hear from two wildfire experts, one based in Arizona, the other here in Nevada, who will tell us why the fire in New Mexico is a harbinger of things to come. But first, for an update, we turn to Elaine Baumgartel, who is a reporter at our sister station in Albuquerque, KUNM. Elaine Baumgartel, welcome to KNPR. It's good to have
morning.
You here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Dave.
Help us to understand the size and the shape of this fire in the Whitewater Baldy Complex.
Well, it's burning in some pretty rugged terrain in southwestern New Mexico in the Gila National Forest. You have to imagine some rocky, rugged canyons that are at higher elevations with ponderosa and conifer trees. That's the area where the fire has been very extreme, especially on the kind of western border of this fire area, very near the Arizona-New Mexico state line. And there are a couple of areas where it has started to progress down out of those higher elevation forests into more pinon and juniper forests, which, if you're not familiar, are more kind of sparsely, the trees are more sparse in those types of forests, and that makes the fire a little bit easier to fight. That's kind of on the southwestern portion of the fire. The newest update this morning from the incident management team is over 400 square miles now. They get that number from, they fly over at night, do an infrared scan of the fire, and that's the new number, about 255,000 acres. They are up to 18% containment, which the fire officials have said they're really feeling really good about that level of containment.
Yeah, so is the fire itself located just in wilderness areas, Gila National Forest, or is it beginning to menace towns or homes or other structures?
Well, it did burn through a community named Willow Creek. It's a small rural community. There were some summer homes that were consumed, about 12 of them, and then another 8 outbuildings. Firefighters have been successful at preventing the fire from burning any more structures. The small town of Mogollon, which is also on the National Historic Register, it's a town with a very rich mining history. That town was evacuated, but residents and business owners have been allowed to go back today as firefighters were able to kind of prevent the fire from moving into that town. They've got sprinklers and all kinds of hoses and things keeping that town pretty soaked and keeping the fire out of that area. So those folks are allowed to go back in today, and the public will be allowed back in there on Wednesday. The Willow Creek community is still under mandatory evacuation. There are some forest closures. The Gila Cliff Dwellings National Monument was closed last week due to some of the smoke and air quality issues in the area. Otherwise, the fire is mostly in wilderness areas, kind of far away from heavily populated areas.
Now, you mentioned that the fire had gone from about 17% to 18% containment. For those of us who don't know all the particulars about firefighting, when they're talking about containment efforts, what does that mean? Is it just control? Is it management of the fire? Is it fighting back a little bit? What do those statistics mean for us?
With this kind of fire that is pretty active, the humidity in this part of the country is really, really low, single digits, which means that the dead trees on the ground, the living trees, they all are pretty dry. They're bone dry, so they ignite very, very easily, which means that the fire can move very quickly. It burns very hot. We've also had some erratic and significant winds. The first weekend that this fire blew up, winds were gusting to over 50 miles an hour. It was part of the reason the fire got so big so quickly. The winds have died down a little bit. We're looking at forecasts of 20 to 30 miles an hour, but that's still kind of close to what fire managers call critical fire weather conditions with the low humidity, the high temperatures. We've got higher than normal temperatures in the forecast this week, and those winds. So what firefighters have to do in this case is instead of going right up to the edge of the fire and fighting to put it out there, they do what's called backburning operations, where they set up outside the fire perimeter and then they start igniting fuels there and controlling the fuels and burning back towards the fire itself, so that as the fire moves forward, it reaches areas that have already been burned by the fire crews. So that is what they call containment, where the fire officials use the terms black lined hard, meaning that the fire line perimeter outside the actual fire has been burned towards the fire itself, and there's a black line there, so that the wild out of control part starts to die down as it gets to this area that firefighters have already kind of gotten rid of the dry fuels there.
It seems there's a trend for increased numbers of fires as well as increases in their intensity. What do fire and forest officials say about that?
Well, it's the prolonged drought. This part of the country has seen very little rain over the past few years. Then you have higher temperatures and the erratic, windy conditions. I mean, the winds are pretty standard for this time of year in this part of the country, although they have at times been more extreme. And so that combination of those conditions and also the history of suppression of fire in wildlands across the U.S., have combined to leave these forests with a lot of unburnt fuel that may have burned naturally a long time ago in smaller fires, but because it didn't, it's just waiting to explode.
Elaine Baumgartel is a reporter and host of Morning Edition at our sister station in Albuquerque, KUNM. Elaine, thanks so much for joining us with
thanks
that
update. Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
Now, joining us from the studios of KNAU in Flagstaff, Arizona, Dr. Wally Covington, Regents Professor and Director of the Ecological Restoration Institute at Northern Arizona University. And Scott Abella is with us, too. He's an Associate Research Professor in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health at UNLV. Gentlemen, welcome to both of you. It's good to have you here.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
Dr. Wally Covington, there is such a thing as a good fire and a bad fire. How do you explain the difference?
Yeah, I guess, you know, for ecologically, the way we think about good and bad fires is good fires would be those fires that are burning naturally and are part of the ecosystem's evolutionary history. So all the plants and animals are adapted to them. And then bad fires would be fires that are burning out of the natural history of the system. So they're likely to have more consequential, negative consequences than a natural fire.
Okay, so the Whitewater Baldy Complex Fire in Gila National Forest, did it start as a good fire or a bad fire?
Well, it's given the heavy fuel loadings that we now have west-wide in these dry forest types, it's just about any fire can be a terrible consequences for the ecosystem. So it didn't start as a good fire because the fuels were not natural on the site. When you have tree densities and other fuels that are so outside the natural range of variability, and you have a fire started in it, then you get this severe, unnatural fire behavior in a forest, these dry, frequent fire forests. So that kind of fire would have been natural, for example, in lodgepole pine or in forests that are adapted to crown fires.
So when you say we're outside the normal variability with the density of forests and such, how far outside the norm are we right now?
Well, quite a bit. So we've had fire exclusion throughout the West since about the 1870s to 1880s. These forests and shrublands often burned anywhere from 2 to 10 years. Every 2 to 10 years, there'd be a low-intensity surface fire that would creep along through grasses and a few needles, a few years of pine needle accumulation, prevent tree seedlings from becoming overly dense, recycle nutrients, all that sort of stuff. And so now, after 120, 130 years of fire exclusion, you're missing 20 to 30 or 35 fires that should have been occurring then and keeping these systems regulated within their natural bounds.
Now, there's an odd juxtaposition of that with something that you have said many times, which is the idea that you've said that the forests in the southwest of the United States are in decline. What do you mean when you say that?
Well, by in decline, what we're talking about is we're starting to, we've been seeing now since, the 1920s, unnatural population dynamics. So it's kind of population disorders is what we call them. It'd be like a tissue disorder in a human being. So we're starting to see crashes of some species, especially threatened and endangered species. We're seeing unnatural disturbance regimes, not just severe crown fires, but the less obvious and less threatening, in a way, insect and disease outbreaks that kill especially the oldest trees in the ecosystem. We're seeing nutrient cycling degraded, so less and less nitrogen availability. So just a lot of symptoms that are pretty indicative that the ecosystems are unhealthy and that something needs to be done about it.
Okay, so we've kept fire out of these ecosystems as humans for quite some time. Are you saying that maybe one of the solutions to this imbalance is to kind of let fire back into it?
Well, not so much. You know, when I came here in 75, that was my assumption, and started trying to use prescribed burning, controlled burning, to thin out these excess younger trees. And what I found was that on sites with the kinds of densities that are common throughout the western U.S., you know, ponderosa pine and frequent fire forest occur from British Columbia down into Mexico, and from Nebraska and Texas and South Dakota all the way over to the West Coast. So anyway, we started trying to use fire, reintroduce fire carefully, and what we found was that you couldn't develop a prescription that could safely, simultaneously thin out the younger trees and yet conserve the older trees that are so important for biological diversity. And as a matter of fact, a couple of the fires that I started back in the 70s got up into the crowns of the trees, and I was actually thinking that this might be the shortest tenure for a professor ever at Northern Arizona University.
So ultimately, Wally Covington, what is the remedy? How to bring things back into balance?
Yeah, by 5 years into my research program on restoration, just using fire alone, it was obvious it wasn't working. We're killing the old trees because of the heavy bark slough that's around the base of the trees. It wasn't dynamic fire. It would smolder and heat so much that it would girdle the tree. It would kill the phloem, the tissues that carry water and nutrients down to the roots, and as well as the xylem that carry water up to the canopies of the trees. So once we discovered that, then we figured out, well, some surgery is needed before you start reintroducing natural fire. And so that's where we started then mechanically thinning out these younger trees and then reintroducing fire. And that's worked like gangbusters. And one of the advantages, a lot of those younger trees can be used to make a variety of engineered forest products that weren't around when I came here that can actually be sold. So you can actually help to offset the cost of the treatment to restore ecosystem health if you can find markets for those younger trees.
So the treatment, I surely, you know, if you're including logging and all kinds of other things, surely that treatment can't be cheap.
Well, it's not. And that's been the problem. You know, our experience has been that cost about $500 or $1,000 an acre to do it without utilization, to do just the thinning and the burning. Now, with utilization, the Four Forest Restoration Initiative here around Flagstaff, it's a pretty creative project to try to restore 2.4 million acres. The first contract's just been announced on that, and the new engineered forest products industry that's coming in are saying that they will pay $22 an acre to do the thinning treatments, instead of it costing $500 to $1,000 an acre when you have no place to put the wood.
So, is the free market an element of this solution then? It kind of sounds like it is.
Yeah, it's pretty much got to be. You know, our federal budget and our state budgets too. There's not enough money in the Treasury to really do this and continue to provide the basic social services and defense and other services that we all want from government. So that's where we're trying to look at this win-win approach. You know, a win for the ecosystem, a win for biological diversity, for watersheds, and an economic win. In fact, Scott and I often refer to this as restoring the ecologic and economic integrity of Western landscapes.
Yeah. Now, I want to turn to Scott Abella. He's the Associate Research Professor in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health at UNLV. Scott Abella, as we speak, we're kind of focusing on this fire in the Gila National Forest in southwest New Mexico, but there's also a 5,000-acre fire burning on the Nevada-Utah border about 150 miles north of Las Vegas. And it's not hard to find people in southern Nevada and even outside the state who believe that since we're talking about the Great Basin and the Mojave, the large deserts, wildfires aren't an issue. And I gather that, to your way of thinking, that's not accurate.
Well, certainly the wildfires are an issue in Nevada. both in the forests where, you know, we have very similar problems to the rest of the West with massive increases in tree density and fuels. And then in the deserts, we have a different problem where grasses from other continents have invaded and created a whole bunch of fuel in these deserts that really didn't used to burn. And so now we are seeing very large fires.
So ultimately, if we're somebody in the Las Vegas Valley, in the middle of Clark County, what would you tell them if they say, okay, why should I care about these things? Isn't this just a part of nature?
The Spring Mountains, for example, also known as Mount Charleston, just west of Las Vegas, are just an amazing place. Very important economically with the ski area, restaurants up there. One of the only places in southern Nevada to actually recreate during the summer in forest and ski in the winter. So very important to us, in addition to having plants and animals that are endemic, which means they occur nowhere else in the world other than here in southern Nevada. Streams, springs. So this mountain is very important to us. And like other places, we've had massive changes in the forest. Very large increases in tree density, fuels have changed. So the Forest Service and others are working to do restoration right here in southern Nevada as well.
We're talking with Scott Abella, Associate Research Professor in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health at UNLV, and Dr. Wally Covington, Regents Professor and Director of the Ecological Restoration Institute at Northern Arizona University. They are joining us from our sister station in Flagstaff, KNAU, and we're talking about why the number of wildfires in the West particularly has been increasing along with their intensity. Examples include the Whitewater Baldy Complex fire, which is now burning in southwest New Mexico, and it's the largest wildfire in New Mexico history. Wally Covington, you have said that we need to bring the forests back to normal and that we're only 1% there. When you say normal, what do you mean?
By normal, what I'm talking about is forests that are self-regulating, so that natural disturbance regimes, natural food webs, predator-prey dynamics are working to keep these ecosystems healthy. It's like in human health. You know, if you, in a way, sometimes I think about this overabundance of trees and fuel and across the landscape as if these ecosystems are kind of obese and need to lose some weight. And so when we talk about getting back to healthy conditions, we're essentially trying to get these ecosystems so they don't require such heroic measures to try to prevent unnatural disturbances from occurring. So that's kind of the bottom line.
Do you know a healthy forest when you see one? What does it look like? What's different about it?
Yeah, so the healthy forest in these frequent fire, ponderosa pine, Jeffrey pine, you know, longleaf pine forest, we know from early settlement records what they were like when they were self-sustaining. They were open and park-like. Instead of having hundreds of trees per acre, there were only maybe 20 to 40 trees per acre, something like that. On some of the sites, there are now 1,000, even 5,000 trees per acre where it's dense sapling thickets. And that overabundance of trees is a threat even without fire burning through them, because there's no room for the grasses and wildflowers and the shrubs to grow. There's not sufficient water flowing from the systems because all of the snow and precip, so much of it gets hung up in the canopies of the trees and the heavy fuels on the surface of the land. So we know it from there. We also know it from areas where we haven't had fire suppression and overgrazing. We've got research sites down in Mexico that have uninterrupted fire regimes. They're open and park-like. There's an abundance of birds and mammals and butterflies, and just they make our forest look depauperate, kind of like biological deserts up here. So we use those as a reference point. We call that the within the natural range of variability, or consistent with the evolutionary environment. Those systems are self-sustaining. They produce a lot more water. They have greater biological diversity, and they're just beautiful.
So Scott Abella, how much should we let nature take its course in restoring the forest, and how much should we engineer the forest?
I think, you know, we can really mimic natural patterns, you know, rather than kind of an engineering perspective. As Dr. Covington was just saying, we can really kind of use the natural forest as a template for us to do restoration. And again, try and bring back fire as a very safe process, a self-regulating process to reduce the density of trees. You know, after we have done thinning and really trying to get the ecosystem back on a favorable trajectory. Also very important is that we try to give these forests as good of a chance as possible to adapt to climate change. You know, these current forests aren't even adapted to conditions that we have today, nonetheless, you know, potentially drier and warmer conditions in the future.
So with the fires we have today, it seems to me that the destruction appears to be more complete, you know, thoroughly burned through, and that could mean some areas are destroyed for decades, if not centuries. Why does that happen?
It takes a very long time for trees to regenerate here in the Southwest. You know, we need a certain combination of rainfall and temperature, and so for the pine cones and so forth to produce seed that will germinate, that doesn't happen very often. You know, that could maybe only happens every few decades. So, you know, from that kind of perspective, you know, we know, you know, that it might take several decades for a seed to germinate, and then several decades for the tree to grow. And that's assuming that we haven't had soil erosion and so forth, which is very common on very steep slopes. So you're right. We're looking at many decades to centuries for a lot of these forests to recover.
So Wally Covington, if the number of fires has increased and the intensity of the fires has grown, is this something we just need to learn to adjust to expect to happen, maybe expect things to get worse over the next couple of decades?
Well, you know, I think things are going to get worse over the next couple of decades, without a doubt. But certainly it's nothing that we should be willing to accept. You know, these high mountain areas are critically important. It's where almost all of the water comes from that recharges the ground table, that fills up our lakes, that makes streams flow and springs and wet meadows. It's a major source of biological diversity. And as you well know, in Las Vegas, it's a great place to escape to when it's 110 degrees. So, you know, we need to keep these forests healthy and robust. And the way to do that is through ecological restoration. We know how to do it. We've got 30 years of research that tells us how to do it. The time is now to get up to a scale, hundreds of thousands of acres instead of the few thousands of acres we've been treating, and at a pace at the rate at which these fires are occurring. So just one more thing then. We've always had fire in these types, but they were sustaining fires. They were surface fires that were natural. What we've got today is these completely unnatural fires that are burning through the canopies of the trees and burning with a temperature and intensity that is devastating, not just to the organisms, the trees and the wildlife, but to the soils, as Scott was saying. We've got whole mountainsides starting to march down to the sea, essentially, as erosion occurs. Flooding is tremendous. So anyway, I think it's obvious that we don't want to live with forests that are degraded. We need these forests to be healthy.
Yeah, and you say it's going to get worse. What does worse look like? Does it look like mountainsides eroding and, as you say, finding their way to the sea?
Yeah, anywhere in the West, you don't have to drive for 2 hours before you see what worst looks like these days. The worst looks like degraded forest landscapes. So the soil is severely eroded. Often what you're left with is just rocks, not much soil left at all. Instead of diverse, healthy, open forest, many of these areas are converted for a long time to scrublands just that are very depauperate. Instead of a steady stream flow, you see flash floods. You see flooding occurring and wiping out downstream for hundreds of miles, having impacts on the quality of the water habitat as well.
So with the New Mexico fire already breaking some records this early in the year, I guess maybe this question is for both of you. What does this mean for us? Does it mean we can expect another record-breaking year of fire this year?
Well, I think we've got close to it. Of course, last year was a huge record. record breaker. Back in 2002, we had the Rodeo Chedeski fire, you know, 470,000 acres. At the same year, we had the Big Biscuit fire in southwestern Oregon, about 400,000 acres. So that we have crossed a critical threshold. We crossed this threshold about 1996 when we started seeing 20,000 acre fires in these frequent fire forests. Now we're at the 100,000 acre plus fires, which we call mega fires. So now, under especially these, as Scott was saying, the severe drought and the climate change that we're seeing with extreme wind, this is our future unless we get on top of it. And we don't have much time. We got 20 years maybe at the outside to really break up this landscape scale fuel load that we've got.
Dr. Wally Covington is Regents Professor and Director of the Ecological Restoration Institute at Northern Arizona University Flagstaff. Scott Abell is an Associate Research Professor in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health at UNLV. Gentlemen, thank you both very much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Our producers are Luis Hernandez, Irene Noguchi, and Lee Hernandez. Our technical director is Rich Copeland. Ian Milchrist is senior producer of the program. Reporter, Jude Joffe Block, and the news director of Nevada Public Radio's Adam Burke. Keep today's conversation going. Visit us at knprtalk.org. I'm Dave Becker. Thanks for joining us today for KNPR's State of Nevada.